Welcome to Why Is It So? Your last defense for common sense with your co-hosts, Paul Zammit and Vince Lochisano.
Welcome once again to Why Is It So? My name is Paul Zammit. Unfortunately, my co-host, Vince Lochisano, who won't be joining us today because he caught a severe bout of flu. He will be spending most of his day in bed recovery. We all wish him well. However, I am very happy and looking forward to our topic today. Looking back at our first podcast, which was only a month ago, it was about the Carlton Football Club board shenanigans, about changing the constitution of the club in a clandestine type of way. Our second topic, which was uploaded only last week, was a completely different topic. That was about the voice referendum, which we're about to have. It has confused the hell out of everyone. They don't know where they're coming or going. They're not quite sure which way they're going to go, but it's there. When we started podcasting, we said that we didn't want to be tied down to one topic all the time, and we wanted to cover various topics of the day. Well, we are continuing with our mantra and delivering a completely different topic again. And I will have the pleasure of introducing our special guest shortly. Firstly, I would like to tell you a little bit about his achievements. He served 38 years with the Victorian Police Force. When he graduated from the Police Academy, he spent a few months at police headquarters before being placed at the Footscray Western Suburbs District Station for approximately 8 years. And for the first half of that time, there he was in uniform and then as a detective with CIB Division at Footscray. His next position was a stint of 12 years with the Internal Investigations Division, which, if my memory serves me correctly, has had a change of name and is now called Professional Standards. Then he moved to the drug squad for 3.5 years, where he spent some time working undercover. After the drug squad, he was assigned to the Homicide Division, where he served for 17 years, and he felt that he had found his niche. When Police Command decided to have a shake-up and rotate most of the officers in major crime squads, were located from one division to another. He found himself back as an administrator with the Piranha Task Force, which I don't think he enjoyed being taken off the road. He then returned to where his journey started at the Armed Robbery Division in Footscray. He decided to retire and resign from the force in 2009. After the force, he wasn't idle. He wrote a crime column for some time at the Herald Sun. He still does corporate speaking. He had a regular spot on the afternoon program on 3AW. He does special PI work. And he is a published autobiography author of the book, The Job, Policing from the Front Line. By this time, you have probably guessed who he is. So I have great pleasure in introducing Charlie Bezina, who is going to tell us about a case he was involved in which has raised its ugly head just recently. Welcome, Charlie. Well, good morning, Charlie. Thank you for popping in and having a word to us today. I believe you're going to tell us about the Paul Denyer episodes. So I'll hand over to you and you can take it from there.
Well, thanks, Paul. Denyer's an interesting one. Paul Charles Denyer, he's I worked on this back in 93 down at Frankston. He's our last serial killer that killed three women here in Frankston, Victoria, back in 93. Interestingly enough, this year he came up for parole. I'll basically just touch base on how we went about solving that case. Started off with, I was the on-call team on this particular day in 93. I got called out, what we normally do, to a murder scene down at Frankston, a place called Lloyd Park in the Cranbourne-Frankston Road. There we had a deceased female, 18-year-old deceased female. She'd been in a little culvert covered with a branch. It was a terrible night. It had been raining quite significantly and her throat had been badly cut and clearly died. And when you go to these scenes, you look for a motive as to why would someone want to kill this person. There was no sexual motivation that we could see. Wasn't a robbery that we could see, so it was a concerning issue that, you know, why has this person or persons killed this young lady who lived not far away. Her body was found late in the evening by a passerby walking his dog. And that's when we started the investigation. She was from Tasmania. She was living with her aunt and uncle. She was attending the Frankston TAFE College. And we started the investigation from that point onwards. So we worked on that for about a couple of weeks, not getting very far at all. We were doing our door knocks, a lot of red herrings, trying to narrow down how did she travel from that location to Frankston CBD, where the TAFE College was. Did she have a boyfriend we didn't know about? Did she get followed? All these things trying to piece together of how she came to be at that location. So we looked at the buses, because she would travel on the buses, if any witnesses may have seen her. And we got a blank in relation to that. And we just continued on the investigation from that one. She was a very nice young lady, no criminal connections whatsoever, and just going about a normal business. And a couple of weeks later, we then get a report of a missing young mother, Debbie Freem, 21-year-old Debbie Freem, who had left her place, left a friend there looking after the baby. She went down to the local milk bar to buy some milk and bread and that type of thing, and she never came home. She was subsequently reported missing. 2 or 3 days later, her body was found next to some farmland just out of Frankston. And again, her throat had been cut. Again, no motivation as to why she was killed. And that's when our biggest concern started happening, because here we had two unrelated females who had suffered the same fate in the same basically locality of the Frankston area, and with similar wounds. So clearly we could see a connection in relation to the two murders, and that's some answers. It basically locked down Frankston because women were very afraid to go about their business. They were looking to us for answers because the buck stops with us. So the pressure was right on. And, you know, there was community meetings at the time. Our Premier at the time, Jeff Kennett, had a community meeting with the community to reassure them that all was being done and to try and lift the fear factor. But they couldn't be lifted because women just wouldn't feature out at all of a night time. So we went about our business again, no closer. But what happened was, after finding Debbie Freem's body, her motor car was located not far from the CBD of Frankston, which is down the Mornington Peninsula. And that was really our first breakthrough, because, you know, your sheer experience tells you that we took it from our experience that the killer must be living within walking distance of where the killer dumped that car. We knew we were looking for a large person because the seat was pushed right back. There was blood stains in the car that turned out to be Debbie Freem's. And most of the items that she bought weren't there. So the plan was to look at a grid of about 2 square kilometres to account for every individual in that particular location and account for their movements. Now, that's a job that would have taken us, I suppose, nearly 18 months to 2 years to account for every I suppose, teenager upwards, because we didn't know what we were looking for. And that was supposed to be on this particular Saturday. So we were continuing my investigation with Lisbeth Stevens. The other team was investigating the Debbie Freem killing. And then, again, some weeks later, this is all happens within the span of mid-June 93 to early July 93, probably a 4-6 week period. Then we had a missing person, a 17-year-old schoolgirl called Natalie Russell. And Natalie had been to the local school and she'd been reported missing. We knew what route she was taking, and we started a police search, or the local police did, whilst we were doing the murder investigations, because we had a lot of missing persons investigations to be done, a lot of missing persons reports. And that evening, it was a Friday night, I recall, it was a Friday night evening that a local police officer found her body on the edge of a golf course. Now, there's 2 golf courses off Sky Road in Frankston that bank on back to each other, but in between the 2 golf courses is a pathway that a lot of people use. And walking down that pathway, there was a hole cut and it's separated by cyclone fences. In one section of the cyclone fence, a hole was cut in the fence. And then about 50 metres down further, another hole was cut in the fence. And that second hole walking down the track is where Natalie's body was found. And again, she's still in a school uniform and she had suffered the same horrific injuries that Debbie Freem had and also Elizabeth Stevens. So really, you can imagine the panic buttons on that. That really went to a skyrocket and became very political as to what are you doing about solving this. And we were really had the pressure put on us. And my boss came up to me and said, Charlie, look, I want you to take over the investigation of Natalie Russell. Your team can stay on the Debbie Freem, the Elizabeth Stevens case. And I was then to run the Natalie Russell case. But unbeknownst to us was, what happened was that afternoon prior to her body being found, there was a lady delivering letters. And because we had the community on so high alert, she happened to look over delivering letters and she sees this little yellow sedan with this big guy stooping down behind the steering wheel. Very suspiciously, which was good for us because she then went to, before mobile phone, she went to a local house, asked to use a telephone and she contacted Triple O and contacted the police. A couple of young uniformed police officers from Frankston went down to that location. The car was had no one sitting in the car. They just did the usual checks. The car came up to a fellow called Paul Charles Denyer of a Frankston address. Nothing to be alerted by. The fact is the car was legally parked, nothing else to arouse suspicion. Those two police members had finished their duty that particular day. The balloon goes up, Natalie's reported missing. The next morning, the two young officers begin work. And then they learn of the fact that we had discovered a body of Natalie Russell at that location where they had checked the car. And they brought that to our attention, the investigators. And lo and behold, we then start the investigation on that car because a car, we had to be eliminated. We didn't know whether the person, Denyer, was involved or not. All we had, his car was parked in the vicinity. So based on that, we looked at where he lived. And surprise, surprise, he lived within our catchment of where our door knock was going to be. On that particular Saturday, we were going to engage probably 200 detectives from the crime squads to start doing door knocks. But that was put on hold while we eliminated or spoke to Denyer. So we left a caller's card at his flat. He was living in a flat with another young lady. And it was a process of elimination. There was nothing to tie him to them, any of the murders at all at that stage. So he came into the Frankston police station and was interviewed by the team leader who was investigating Debbie Freem's murder. And we do our interviews on videotape. So we sat him in the interview room with a camera on a tripod in the room and commenced the interview. And surprisingly enough, for 4 hours, he maintained, and he answered all questions without a problem. Pardon me. But he put himself at every crime scene. We asked him about where were you at the Cranbourne Road or Lloyd Park. Look, I was down there on that particular day because I was visiting my mother's place, which was true. Okay, we had another woman guy missing at near Seaford Railway Station, Debbie Freem. Where were you on that particular date? Oh, look, I was in that area because I normally go to the railway stations to pick up my partner. And yeah, I put himself there. So cunningly enough, and this guy's an obese guy, he's 21 years of age at that stage, and bit of a baby face, and answered all the questions. But what struck us was the fact is, you know, he was able to pinpoint his location days and weeks prior to that. And, you know, I think I'd be hard-pressed to identify where I was probably a week ago, if let alone 3 or 4 weeks ago. So that became suspicious to us. And we also noticed that he had injuries to his hands, which is not uncommon when you get knife killings. The hands slip on the blade or whatever the case may be. So, but we're still in the position of trying to prove or disprove this guy's involvement. Quite happily answering our questions and making denials. I don't know what you're talking about, but I was in that area. And you know I was in Sky Road because you told me you checked my car there. What was your car doing there? Oh, it overheated. Where were you? I was out there getting some water for my car. Had an answer for everything. So we went on our business, and that was about 4 hours of denials whilst he's answering questions. Then we had to postpone the interview because what we wanted to do is do what we call a forensic procedure. We wanted to get a blood sample off him, plus a medical examination to see if he had any injuries. Again, we have to then ask for his permission in those particular times of doing it. And luckily enough, he gave us permission. If he didn't give us permission, we'd have to then go for a 10 or 12, 15 page affidavit to prove to a magistrate that this guy was a relevant suspect. But lucky enough for us, he said, yep, no problems. I'll give you permission to have your police doctor come and examine me. So he stopped the interview tape. He wanted to go to the men's and relieve himself. So he was escorted to the toilet with another different detective that wasn't doing the interview. So I think the wheels in his head were turning at that stage of saying, well, you know, what's going on? I'm going to get medically examined. Whilst they're in the men's, he looked at this detective who was wearing a crucifix. He asked him if he was a Christian, and the detective said, I was. And he just said, I did the three of them. I killed the three women, just like that. Took him straight back, started the interview again, another 4 or 5 hours. And basically, I saw Elizabeth Stevens, or this woman, get off the bus. It was Elizabeth Stevens. I heard the urge to kill, so I abducted her, took her to the park, killed her. I was collecting my wife, my partner from the Seaford Railway Station, saw this woman. He initially tried to abduct a woman getting off the train, but she escaped. That didn't deter him. He saw Debbie Freen pull up in the car, didn't know who she was, hopped in the back seat of the car, held a knife to her throat, and killed her. And then the third one, it was actually he planned the murder. He cut holes in the fence, went to a park initially to find some school kids. They were too many. He then stopped in Sky Road, cut two holes in the fence. He could see Natalie Russell walking across the road, so he quickly ran into the first hole that he'd cut in the fence and hid under some bushes. As Natalie walked past, he came out of that hole, followed her. As he got closer to the second hole, he came very close to her, abducted her, pushed her in and killed her. So from that point onwards, we had no idea, as I say, and wasn't for that one phone call that broke it, because this guy would have continued to kill. He initially pleaded guilty to the three murders and the attempted abduction. And the judge gave him life imprisonment by three with no minimum.
So with this guy here, there was no sexual things with him. It was just purely the killing of the people.
Urge to kill. He just wanted to kill. And then we found out later that his first victim, well before Elizabeth Stevens, he broke into a flat of a woman that he knew. He was going to kill her. And she wasn't home, so we killed her cats and then wrote on the wall some with the blood of the cats and that type of stuff. But we didn't marry that up at the time.
Unbelievable.
But this guy, why'd you do it? I just had the urge to kill since I was 15. So it was a thrill kill. And he would have continued to kill had not that lady made that phone call. But then ironically, he's 21 years of age. He pleads guilty. The first judge, Frank Vincent, says three life imprisonments, no minimum. But because the way our justice system is here in Victoria, but because he pleads guilty and does us all a favour by not having witnesses called, he accepts all the evidence by pleading guilty, he's got to get a discount. So the community gets penalised, police get penalised, he appealed, and then the next court hearing was, he had three lives imprisonment, but now you'll have a minimum of 30 years before you're eligible for parole. And that is in 2023, where we are today. In April of this year, he applied for parole. He has not done any courses in jail to better himself. Whilst he was in jail, incarcerated, he wanted to be a woman, become a woman.
Yeah, I heard that, yeah.
And he never got his wish, and there was no operations done. He never underwent any rehabilitation courses. And subsequently, there was a big media campaign to keep him in jail because this guy will always kill. I was part of that and got on the media and it was very political. The Premier, Daniel Andrews, said he's in his right place. He applied for parole. He's 51 at this stage. He'll always kill. The parole board refused his parole, but this guy can apply for as many times as he likes for parole.
Is this the one that Dan Andrews is now looking at stopping them from being able to apply for parole?
Well, that's the thing. It's the opposition. It's the Liberal Party that have put it up. They wanted a law put in place. Currently, there's two laws specifically for the two individuals to keep them in jail forever or until they're old and infirm they can't be a danger. One is Julian Knight, who killed 7 in Hoddle Street and injured 19. There's specific legislation. He got life imprisonment minimum of 27 years back in the 80s, late 80s. They made a specific law. You will stay in jail until you're no longer a threat to the community. Then we had Craig Minogue. Craig Minogue was a Russell Street bomber.
Oh, yeah.
Same deal. He came up for parole. He got a doctorate whilst he was in jail. Hatred of police. He killed a policewoman in the explosion, and he could have killed hundreds more with the amount of the detonation that was on that particular car. And they made specific legislation to keep him in jail for the same thing. And that's what we want to do with Denyer. So because the opposition put it up, Dan Andrews has now said, no, I'm going to leave it to the parole board. So every time he applies for parole, the poor old families of the deceased people will be hanging on tender hooks to see if he gets parole.
Yeah, they don't want him to get out, obviously.
Exactly. Yeah. And then where's he going to go? If he says, oh, well, won't move to Frankston. Regardless of where he goes, right. He will always kill. So I don't want him next to my place. I don't want him in my community. He must not be released. But Dan Andrews, we say, or everyone is saying basically, community sentiment is, it's now become political because the opposition have put up this bill that we want legislation passed. Mm. And we've had the Greens and all these other ones have said, no, we'll support the government of the day and we will not vote to keep him in jail. And there's no rhyme or reason why that should be.
Yeah.
None at all. Keep him in jail. So now the three deceased families have to go through this every time he applies for parole.
So how often can he apply?
As often as he likes.
Like once a year?
Yeah, once every fortnight, once every month.
Oh, really?
Once every 6 months. He can apply as often as he likes.
And then the
parole board
will decide, oh, yes, you can come in and talk to us about it.
And he might play the system and say, I've done the course. I've done a sexual rehabilitation course. I've done this. And try and con people. Mm. And then the decision will remain with the parole board to say yay or nay. And it's a big issue. Mm. This is a new parole board. And prior to this new parole board, there was a major inquiry because prior to this new parole board, the old parole board, they had released some 12 people on parole, and these 12 they released on parole killed again and murdered. So this new parole board is really looking a lot more crucially at the evidence they have about releasing someone.
Whether they can, yeah, at least learn or be not such a big, threat to the community.
Correct, they have to because the main issue for the parole board is, their main thing is about the safety of the community, putting this guy back out. You can put all the rules and regulations you like. It's like a pedophile. This guy's programmed that way, that he'll always kill. And when he did Natalie Russell, that's the one he planned. So he went from he did it specifically.
Optionistic.
He got better and better at what he was doing and planned Natalie Russell. And it wasn't for that one phone call from that lady delivering letters, he would have gone on killing.
Mm.
So we owe her a great debt because we had no idea. We would have gone through the door knock. It would have taken us 18 months or 2 years to try and account for every individual at every household within that 2 square kilometres.
In which time he'd been killing.
Correct.
All this time.
Correct.
So 100%. You're chasing your tail.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. So that's basically it. So now we continue to fight his parole and there's petitions. And as luck had it, at the time of Natalie Russell, her boyfriend at the time has now become a Liberal minister. So he's in the halls of Parliament in Spring Street and he's one of the big movers to try and get legislation, but you've got to get the government of the day to move legislation to it, and Dan Andrews won't have a part of it.
Charlie, that was very, very interesting. Thank you very much for talking to us about it. And we'd like to have you on again sometime. But we'll see what happens.
No worries, Paul. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much again,
Charlie. All the best.
Bye. We would also like to thank you, our audience, for tuning into our podcasts. If you found our current offering interesting and you would like to hear more from Charlie Bezina, please let us know via our website at whyisitso.au, and we will try and have Charlie back. Charlie's got some very interesting investigations he was involved in, like the Dr. Victor Chang murder in Sydney, the David Hooks, the cricketer who was killed outside a nightclub or bar here in Melbourne, and of course the Black Prince of Lygon Street, Alphonse Gagitano. He's had a hand in most of those things. Now, if you wish to subscribe to our podcast, which is free, you can also do that wherever you listen to us. And if you hit the follow key, you will receive notification as we load up new episodes. So tell your friends about us, and thank you once again.
Thank you for listening to Why Is It So? Make sure you tune into our next episode. Remember, it's your last defence for common sense.